From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Amid the clamor pouring out of the Beltway cable news complex, it's too easy to lose sight of the one thing everyone seems to agree on. Russia interfered in our elections and our politics, and is still at it. And neither our politicians, not our social media titans, or our diplomats have risen to the occasion to their duty to protect us from that. This hour on Point, what do we still have to do to protect the 2020 elections? Join us. Are we ignoring the Russia threat while we fight over this presidency? Are you being trolled, or have you become smarter in the way you get your news? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, where they're at On Point Radio. With me first from Washington is Natasha Bertrand. She covers national security and intelligence and the intelligence community for The Atlantic. You can find a link to her latest reporting on this and many things at our website, onpointradio.org. Natasha, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is obviously fast moving, but bring us up to date what we know right now. Democratic leaders on several House committees have asked Attorney General Bill Barr to turn over the Mueller report by April 2nd. What is the DOJ response to these congressional requests?
So we don't know yet what the response is, but I imagine there may be some pushback there. The report, obviously, is what we need to see. Barr's summary was 4 pages long. We don't know how long the Mueller report actually is, even, which is also kind of perplexing. But I think that the speculation around what Mueller actually found in his report is going to run rampant until we're able to see the actual conclusions that he drew.
Here is President Trump at the White House yesterday praising Robert Mueller. And at the White House yesterday, President Trump telling reporters that he has been subjected to treatment no president should ever have to endure.
We can never let this happen to another president again. I can tell you that. I say it very strongly. Very few people I know could have handled it. We can never, ever let this happen to another president again.
Natasha, President Trump yesterday suggesting that he wants new investigations into the FBI, into the Justice Department, into his political opponents after this Mueller report was released. Where might that lead at this point?
Right. And you also had the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, saying something very similar, that he wants a reckoning for the FBI and the DOJ, particularly about how they handled the Clinton email investigation. So they want to relitigate that. They also want to know more about how the FBI conducted the Russia probe. You know, I think that there's a definite possibility that, at least in the Senate, these investigations could gain some steam. They could request documents from the Justice Department, from the FBI, relating to things like FISA warrants, 302s, which are the interview forms that the FBI agents fill out when they interview witnesses. These are all things that the Republicans now want to focus on. They've kind of turned their ire back onto the investigators. And, you know, they're kind of now taking advantage of this void that we have with the lack of the Mueller report to say, well, we have Barr's conclusions now, therefore we can, you know, put this entire issue to rest. And I don't think that will be satisfying to a large number of people who don't see this as a closed matter just yet, especially because, again, we have not seen the full report.
Right. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell actually just blocked a resolution that would have called on Barr to release the Mueller report to the public, right, saying he believed Barr needed more time to process it, saying, that sensitive material need to be scrubbed from the report. Is that right?
Right. And that is also kind of perplexing because Barr actually did not mention in his summary the fact that classified information existed in Mueller's report. So he said that there were some things in the report that he did want to scrub and to, protect from public disclosure, such as grand jury material. But he did not say that classified information was one of those things. And you would think, though, that if he wanted some kind of fig leaf to give him more cover, to have more time perhaps to go through a declassification review, et cetera, then he would have said in this summary, look, we have classified information here that we will brief Congress on perhaps separately, or we will scrub before we release the final report to the public. But that wasn't in there, which is really curious. And of course, Mitch McConnell's statement there kind of flies in the face of what Trump's own team has been saying, which is release the report. They believe that it's fully exonerating. And the president himself has actually said that he wants the full report to be public. So Mitch McConnell seems to be playing kind of interference here in a way that doesn't necessarily make sense.
Well, while the Barr memo states that the Mueller report concludes that there was no collusion by the president and his circle with Russia, House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff said he sees plenty of evidence of collusion. Here he is on ABC's This Week. This is on Sunday.
There is evidence quite in the public realm that the president sought to make money from the Russians, sought the Kremlin's help to make money during the presidential campaign while denying business ties with the Russians. That is obviously deeply compromising. And if it's this president's view that he still wants to build that tower when he is out of office, that may further compromise his policy towards Putin, towards Russia and other things. It's our duty to expose that and take corrective action.
I guess there are a lot of people, Natasha Bertrand, who would say, what? I mean, doesn't the Mueller report end this question of collusion? You know, Adam Schiff can continue to bring it up for political reasons, but hasn't that question now been answered by the special counsel in this report?
No, absolutely not. I think that's totally incorrect, actually. I think that the question of whether or not Mueller found evidence, enough evidence to charge the campaign with a criminal conspiracy with Russia, is not the be-all, end-all of this question of whether or not the president himself was at any point compromised by the Russians, whether any members of his campaign were compromised by the Russians during the election, and what explains the president's kind of continued deference towards Russian President Vladimir Putin and the secrecy that has for so long surrounded their conversations and their interactions. So I think that, you know, when we apply criminal standards to counterintelligence findings, then we might be kind of missing the point. And this is what national security and intelligence experts have been telling me about the importance of getting the full Mueller report to figure out what evidence that he amassed over the last 2 years of his investigation that went beyond whether or not a crime was actually committed. Because when we look at it through that narrow lens, we're unable to explain so much of the campaign's behavior and of the president's behavior during the election, especially, you know, the question of why so many people and Trump himself lied about their interactions with Russia during the election.
Natasha, let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Molly McHugh is a professor at Georgetown's Walsh School of Foreign Service. She studies Russian disinformation campaigns. Molly, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me how Russia reacted to the Barr memo and by extension the Mueller report.
First, I should just caveat that these opinions are my own and have nothing to do with Georgetown University. But I think that, you know, very much agree with what Natasha said, that this four-page letter on its face is so hard to accept, and not because we're all delusional or hysterical about Russia, but just the claim that there were two main Russian lines of effort against the United States in 2016 to influence our election. Then it was this DNC hack and information operations conducted through the Internet Research Agency is false. And we know that. We know there are dozens of other lines of approach through intermediaries and other organizations, through influence campaigns, targeting influential conservative groups and individuals, through money, through other means. And around the edges of all of that are handfuls of Russian intelligence officers that have been identified by Mueller and others. So the idea on its face that this is it and there's no signs there that the Trump campaign was directing any of it is so limited in its view. And I think Natasha's really right that this gets at the challenge of what may be in the Mueller report in terms of the counterintelligence aspects versus a justice aspect. And in general, how we, the West, are looking at Russian influence activities and tools of hybrid warfare and hybrid tactics and how they are meant to change our behavior and influence our societies and how we really have a hard time defining how to deal with these things.
So you study these campaigns, Russia's disinformation efforts. I'm just curious what your response was to Russia's response of all this. I'm looking at Russia's foreign ministry reaction here, their statement. I'm just curious what you saw in that.
You know, I think in general, they're sticking to the talking points they've had since 2016, 2017, which is very much, see, it was all hysteria, which is their word to dismiss all claims that Russia has ever done anything bad in the world. I think the danger is they will really double down on the types of campaigns they've already been running, on the reliance on clouding the information environment as much as possible to try to influence American minds and Western mindset. And I think that as we move toward 2020, it's very clear their behavior is undeterred. Our military commanders say the same thing when they're testifying to Congress. Nothing we have done has changed the way that the Kremlin behaves in the world and toward the West. And that means there are ongoing attacks that target the American people at the level of the individual to change how they act and how they behave. And right now, our government is pretending none of that is happening.
Natasha Bertrand, tell us about your reporting on that. Is that the danger you see, this sort of doubling down by Russia as we move toward 2020?
Yeah, absolutely. And experts say that this actually may embolden them. They completely ignored the findings in Barr's summary, not going to say Mueller's report, because, again, we don't know what's in it. But the findings that Barr laid out that Mueller found, that Russia did interfere in the election in two big ways, through their information warfare and through hacking the Democrats. And I was talking to the former CIA director, Mike Morrell, the other day, and he said, look, this is actually a big win for the intelligence community because it is the second entity outside of the IC that has actually confirmed their findings, their early findings from January of 2017, that Russia did, in fact, interfere in the election. And that, I think, is the big picture that we need to stay focused on as well as we go into 2020, because the Russians are not being deterred on any of this in any meaningful way.
We are asking what, as a nation, still needs to be done to protect the 2020 elections from Russia and other nations. Great panel today, Natasha Bertrand. She covers national security and the intelligence community for The Atlantic. And Molly McHugh, a professor at Georgetown's Walsh School of Foreign Service. She studies Russian disinformation campaigns. And listeners, we'd love to have you join us. Now that President Trump feels cleared of collusion by the Mueller report, do you expect him to turn his attention to this national security threat? Do you expect Congress to get serious and protect us? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. The 2020 election campaign is effectively underway, and so are Russia's efforts to disrupt it. Our national security chiefs have been warning us over and over again, and we're talking about that today. You can join the conversation. Is our government asleep at the wheel on this? What about our social media? Have they become a Trojan horse? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. My guest this hour, Molly McHugh, professor at Georgetown's Walsh School of Foreign Service, and Natasha Bertrand. She covers national security and the intelligence community for The Atlantic. Let me play some clips here. This is from ABC's This Week on Sunday, where former governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, said that even without evidence of collusion, Russia remains a major threat to the 2020 election and that Washington's eye is not on the ball.
The other thing that is a challenge for Republicans and Democrats in the aftermath of this is, are they going to focus on protecting our election in 2020, or are they just going to continue to beat each other senseless over the allegations against the president and against Democrats? They've got to focus on what Bob Mueller really found in this report, which was the biggest number of indictments he did was against those Russians who were trying to infiltrate the election. What are we going to do to stop that in 2020?
And speaking to members of the Senate Intelligence Committee in January, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats warned yet again that Russia and other foreign actors will interfere in the 2020 elections.
We assess that foreign actors will view the 2020 U.S. elections as an opportunity to advance their interests. We expect them to refine their capabilities and add new tactics as they learn from each other's experiences and efforts in previous elections. On the heels of our successful efforts to protect the integrity of the 2018 midterm elections, we are now focused on incorporating lessons learned in preparation for the 2020 elections.
So they're just two of the many voices we have heard on this issue over and over again. Natasha, Molly, speak specifically. Molly, you first. You brought it up, these two strands in the report, in the Mueller report, this two-stranded sort of effort that they focused on, at least, for Russian efforts to interfere in the last election. Describe for us very specifically what those were.
So the two areas that are sort of outlined in the Barr letter on the Mueller report are the one is the DNC hacking effort. So the hack of the DNC and the release of that material to influence how people were viewing the elections. The other is the information operations that were being conducted by the Internet Research Agency, which is sort of a proxy front for Russian intelligence that was running information campaigns against the United States. And I think the second is really the bigger category that there has been so little accounting on. There's been lots of reports and lots of independent researchers have gone through some of the material and tried to analyze the narrative that were being used to target the United States and some of the content. But in general, how these things work, how to shut them down, how to cut them off, has not been addressed and certainly has not been adequately addressed to the American public. If you look at the way that some of our European allies are sort of further ahead on public communications on these efforts. And since the entire category of Russia has been so politicized in our political psyche in this country, there's half the country that believes this never happened and is complete craziness, and the other half that maybe overbelieves in the power of these things. But, you know, information operations are a specific tool of influence that are well documented to work extremely well. And there are cases that we've seen from sort of looking back on the 2016 cycle where there was behavior change affected by information campaigns directed from Kremlin efforts. You know, people came out and protested. People went to events. People did behavioral activities that were suggested by these campaigns, which indicates they have much greater reach than has been documented. And we have not accounted for this and the fact that they are ongoing. And there is currently no method of defense against this for the American public.
Natasha, speak to that. Do you agree?
Yeah, so I think, you know, speaking to experts who study this for a living, I mean, it's very clear that the core issue of Russia, any foreign adversary attacking our election and attacking our democracy is always going to be a political issue in this country just because we're already so divided and because we don't have the leadership, really, that would be necessary to kind of unite the country on this and say, this is unacceptable. This is something we have to deal with head on. And the Brits actually are very united on this issue, are very united. They're not united on a lot, but they're united on the issue of Russian interference. And this was not a politicized issue for them when Russia interfered in the Brexit vote. It was actually something that members of all of the political parties there, virtually all of the parties there, agreed on in terms of having to do something about it. And, you know, I think that hopefully what comes from this report is, from the Mueller report, is, you know, not necessarily more, not more division, but more emphasis on the fact that we need to, you know, drive more funding into upgrading and hardening the country's election infrastructure, that we need to hold tech companies more accountable for what appears on their platforms. You know, going back to election security, we need new voting machines, you know, that produce paper trails. And just overall, we need to set higher standards for cybersecurity and post-election auditing. And that requires manpower and know-how in addition to better hardware. And so this is an area where DHS and, you know, state and local election officials are really going to need to stand up and work together. And hopefully, you know, having moved a little bit past the chapter of, you know, not knowing anything about what Mueller has been investigating and what's in the report, et cetera, we will be able to continue to focus on those core issues. But I do think that we have not been helped at all by the fact that the president has continued to deny up until very recently that Russia interfered at all and that it could have been a 300-pound hacker sitting on his
right.
bed.
And so, Molly McHugh, the president clearly feels vindicated, right, by the Mueller report. What should he be doing now? And what is Congress's role in confronting the Russia threat in 2020? I mean, Natasha talked about state and local election officials, DHS, and other things. Doesn't this start at the top?
Absolutely. I think the point on leadership is a really critical one, and one that I've also been trying to make over and over again these last few years. Mm-hmm. The absence of the voice at the top on this issue has been so critical to eroding a potential American understanding of what is happening. If on day one, after he got the briefing from when he was an incoming candidate or an incoming elected president-elect to the office, when he got the briefing saying Russia had interfered, that there was this information about him, if he had just come out and said, hey, we need to figure out what happened here because Russia declares itself as an adversary of the United States and it says it's attacked our democracy, then he could have washed the stink of this off of himself much sooner. But he didn't do that. And as Natasha said earlier, he continued to lie. Everyone around him lied. And it's not just that he continues to say these things and sort of muddy the water on this. We don't really know. Who knows? Putin says it wasn't him. Could have been anyone. It's that the policy that his administration has engaged in has, again, failed to deter Russian behavior on any scale, military information, other attacks on the United States and the region.
Let me get a couple of calls in here, Natasha and Molly. Scott is first up in Auburn, Alabama. Hi, Scott. Welcome to On Point.
Hey. The lamenting of the politicization of this issue from your Georgetown professor is just sad to me when that's pretty much what she spent the morning doing. We willfully conflate interference, which is real, with collusion, which wasn't. And the Atlantic, you have an Atlantic person there, when the cover of your magazine is impeached, when the Washington Post spends every article every day on collusion, willfully mixing these two issues up, we've ignored everything else. We ignore the fact that Russians have landed in Venezuela yesterday. We spent every ounce of oxygen in the room on taking down a president, which I don't much care for either, but it's been an embarrassment to watch. It's an embarrassment to hear today the partisan nature of the tutting about, you know, gosh, he's not spending time on this. Of course not, because you've said for the last 2 years that he is colluding with the Russians.
So, Scott, do you think we need to find a more neutral way to pitch the problem to the American people so that Americans understand in a very bipartisan way that we've got to tackle this problem, that Russian interference in our election is a very real threat to our democracy? Do you see it that way,
sure,
Scott?
Sure, of course I do. But the day that the Republicans or the Democrats or the Washington Post or the Atlantic leads on this issue in a nonpartisan way will be a day that I would long to see, but I do not see coming.
Scott, thank you. Natasha, Molly, there's Scott. He hears partisanship in your voices, in your reporting. Natasha, your response.
Yeah, so I've actually written a lot about election interference, and I wrote a lot last year about how the Republicans and the Democrats were having serious disagreements on the issue of whether or not to use hacked material that might have been leaked to them during the campaign, and how the Democrats pledged not to and how the Republicans would not pledge not to. And so I think there was still a very serious disconnect between the parties there on whether or not to lead on this issue. But also just note that, you know, the media reported the facts of the collusion that did occur between the Trump campaign and Russia during the election. And I would reiterate that the fact that Mueller did not find enough evidence to charge the campaign with a criminal conspiracy does not mean that there is no evidence that any such coordination actually occurred. We have to remember that he's defining coordination as between the campaign and the Russian government. Well, what was the Trump Tower meeting about, where they eagerly met with the Russians hoping to get material on Hillary Clinton? Why was the campaign chairman giving internal polling data to a suspected Russian agent? These are all questions that the counterintelligence aspect of Mueller's report, even if he found and according to Barr, he did, that there was not enough evidence there to charge the campaign with a crime, I would be shocked if people weren't more curious about those events and what they said about the campaign's willingness to pursue these kinds of ties to Russia, especially given the president's pursuit of a massive business deal there that he lied about during the election.
And Molly, though, I hear Scott's point, and it's an important one. When you hear all of this through many partisan media filters, does the severity of the issue itself, drilling back down to Russia's interference in our election, does the severity of the issue and the importance of the message and doing something about it really resonate? Are we losing it?
Look, this has become a partisan issue, and it is not because one side made it a partisan issue. It is because of the way both sides engaged in this after the election, which is Fox News decided it wasn't a thing, and CNN and MSNBC, if we're looking only at the media, the sort of TV media landscape, focused on the ongoing investigations and details that were coming out in a non-dismissive way. What's so interesting to me about that question is I'm purposefully raising the issues that the president could have done something about this. I am, if you know me and you know my work and you know my history, I was equally critical of the Obama administration and its reset policy and how that gave Putin space to expand his influence in the world throughout the Obama administration and led us up to where we were in 2016. And that even hearing discussion of the fact that Russia is attacking the United States was interpreted by that caller as a partisan discussion when I am not saying that is the problem that we're having in the country right now. He's absolutely right. There's stuff happening in Venezuela that we need to pay attention to. There's stuff happening in Syria we need to pay attention to. Everywhere that we are in strange proxy conflicts with Russia, we are at a disadvantage right now because of this issue that is unresolved in the United States. And we have no leadership on this issue in the White House, in the State Department, within the diplomatic circles, in the way that we need it to come. It needs to be a top-down issue and a priority for the National Security Council, and it is not. If anything, they are coordinating with the Russians on these issues that are pipe dreams for them on Iran and North Korea, and value that information that they're getting from the Kremlin so much that it's blinding their judgment on issues that are more important to us.
Scott, thank you very much for your call. Let's go back to the phone. Steve in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. I have a question and a point.
Okay.
My question is that I don't understand why Russian interference in our elections is not an act of war. I'm not advocating war, but I think to consider it a political issue is wrong. We need to be more forceful in our response. The other comment is that on the news I was reading today, it pointed out that Trump and his allies are now plotting their revenge against the Democrats. That's disappointing to me. I think it's time to get on with governance and stop the tit-for-tat nonsense. That's really my two issues.
Steve, thank you very much. To Steve's first point, Natasha, you first, this act of war, that sort of defining this as a political issue isn't right, that we need to be more forceful in our response. What are lawmakers saying about that? What are you hearing in your reporting?
Yeah, so this was, I think, an issue that was debated in 2016 when the intelligence community saw the first signs of Russia interfering. Some people did consider it to be akin to an act of war. People in the intelligence community and many lawmakers equated it to, the 9/11 attack, that it was just as serious, that the warning signs are flashing red, is what the director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, said last year about continued Russian election interference. So I think and in a way that they were flashing red before 9/11. So I do think that it's been framed in these terms by people who understand the threat that is posed. I think also there's been a reluctance to frame it that way because, of course, we don't want any kind of escalation with Russia that might result in a kind of on-the-ground conflict, right? And so the intelligence community has been figuring out how to push back on Russia's election interference and Russia's cyber attacks in the U.S. in a way that also does not prompt that escalation. And we saw that during the 2018 midterms when the IC actually took down internet research agency trolls, Russian trolls, in order to prevent them from waging a disinformation campaign during the midterms. And that was, you know, seen by some as kind of a pinprick, but seen by others as a very kind of savvy way to step in between the Russians and the U.S. voters in a way that would not necessarily launch a dramatic conflict. So they're still kind of trying to figure out how best to navigate this.
Molly McHugh, I have about 20 seconds. Give me your take on this.
I very much agree we need to do more in this space. In terms of definitional issues, I mean, the Russians declare they're in an information warfare or in an information war with us, and we need to take that seriously and understand what that means and come up with a definition of information defense for our people.
Steve, thanks so much for the call. Molly McHugh, Georgetown's Walsh School of Foreign Service, is with us. Natasha Bertrand, she's a reporter at The Atlantic. Listeners, we are focusing our attention, your attention, on the one thing that our politicians mostly agree on, that Russia has been using the internet and our social media to create divisions in our country. And we're asking what we're doing, what we're not doing to counter that interference. You can join the conversation. What are you hearing here this hour? What's your biggest worry about what Russia's doing? A cybersecurity expert joins us next. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking this hour about what we know now about Russia's ongoing efforts to influence politics from the Capitol down to conversations between neighbors all across this country. Would you consider logging off your social media account in the weeks before the election? If we do nothing, what's going to happen in 2020? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Speaking on NPR's Morning Edition today, Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose said that while Russia interfered in American politics, he didn't think they actually changed any votes.
Did our intelligence professionals tell us, and we believe them, that the Russians attempted to cause discord or sow discontent? Yes. But we have no reason to believe that they actually changed any votes or really hacked, quote unquote, the election.
My guests this hour, Molly McHugh, professor of Georgetown's Walsh School of Foreign Service, Natasha Bertrand, who covers national security and the intelligence community for The Atlantic. And right now, I want to dig deeper at this point into the question of what our social media companies, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Reddit, and the rest, what they're doing to protect our conversations, our debates from a foreign enemy. And for that, we turn to Tim Starks. He covers cybersecurity for Politico. He writes its morning cybersecurity newsletter. And you can see his latest reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Tim, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Great to be here.
So social media is such a huge part of this conversation. It's a huge part of the problem. It's been weaponized, clearly. Have the social media companies taken the right steps to protect the 2020 elections?
Yeah, let me go slightly back to the clip you just played, because it's interesting. I want to say 2 points about that. First, there are varying views over whether there was an influence that was successful or not. And when you're talking about the social media aspect and or the aspect that was related to the hacking, where these emails from Democrats were leaked and were somewhat unflattering, the former director of national intelligence says he personally believes they did have an impact. There have been some studies done that suggest that they might have been responsible for switching votes. Some of those studies are debatable. The other question is related to the actual hacking of the machines themselves. There is no evidence that they have been hacked, but that doesn't mean that they weren't. In fact, there's been a point of contention lately between the Department of Homeland Security and Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon about the fact that you cannot, nobody has actually gone into the machines and audited them, looked at the paper ballots. Like, there's not been a major effort to forensically detect whether they were hacked. So to the question you started with, which is, have they done enough, I think everyone agrees. In fact, you would probably find that the companies themselves agree that they have not done enough.
So a lot in there. Tell me, who would be responsible for that effort to actually go in and check the machines, check to see if there's a fingerprint in there?
That is precisely the problem, is that there is no responsibility. DHS does not have the authority. The federal government does not have the authority to mandate these kind of audits. The department has said we would definitely be able to do so if it was requested, but there's not a lot of information out there suggesting that it was requested, that the states asked for DHS help to look at these machines.
So why hasn't Facebook and some of these other big social media giants, why haven't they done more to protect consumers? Is it because they haven't been mandated to do that?
Well, certainly a mandate would have an influence on whether they did it or not. I do think the major problem is that they were caught off guard by this. A lot of the people who run these companies, you know, if you look at various memos that were passed around and that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook leader, testified about, they looked at this company as a force for good, that it was a way to connect people. They didn't envision the ways in which it would be abused. So they're behind in a lot of ways. And it's the example that comes to mind of how difficult it is to control what goes on their platform is YouTube was taking down what they said. You remember the shooting in New Zealand, the Christchurch mm-hmm. shooting. Mm-hmm. They were taking down those videos at one point once every second. They have algorithms. All these companies have algorithms to like try to detect these kinds of videos, but they just don't have the human amount of people
capacity.
Reckon with that. Mm-hmm. That's a very huge and difficult problem that they are very behind on, just by the nature of the thing.
But doesn't the problem go deeper, Tim, than just playing catch up on these things? I mean, isn't there something fundamental to the very design of these social media platforms that makes them more inherently useful, right, to malignant actors?
Very much so. One of the things that people have said is that Russia's always been doing information warfare. This is just makes it a lot easier for them to do it. The issue of the playing catch up. They have taken down, some of these sites have taken down hundreds of pages and user accounts. But there are other ways that this is hard to reckon with from a standpoint of policy making. There's the major bill in Congress that even kind of comes close to doing this is the Honest Ads Act, which just required some additional disclosure about ads. But ads are only one part of the problem. Russia put up ads, but they also, it's easy to put up a Facebook page and just start one. It's hard to catch up with that and get that taken down, because you can create them pretty quickly.
Let me get some more calls in here. Karen in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Karen. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hello. I had a comment or an observation, something that I've heard from friends and family who support Trump, and their reaction is that they don't go into the polling place with a Russian. They're making their vote on their own, that they don't need anyone else to think for them, and if there is any kind of propaganda coming from Russia, if it happens to agree with them, that's not even an issue. They're already thinking it.
Karen, thank you. Tim Starks, it's a really interesting point, and it goes back to what the Ohio Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, said, you know, that there's no reason to believe that Russia actually changed any votes here. What's your response to Karen there?
You know, I don't doubt that people's parents think for themselves. It's one of those things, though, where even if you go back before this dawn of the internet age, it was always hard. It was always, even the best of us, even the smartest of us, even the most well-trained of us at trying to suss out truth from falsehood would occasionally find themselves passing on an urban legend and didn't even realize they were doing it. There is a big problem with media literacy in this country, and that's one of the sort of few areas where there's been an attempt to address this. Like, there's, I think, according to the Poynter Institute, there are 24 states that have or are trying to pass a law on bolstering media literacy in public schools. But if you look at public opinion polls about even basic facts about anything in the world right now, it's not very encouraging. Things like how many people think the moon landing was faked. There is an inclination for people to believe what they want to believe. And that makes them vulnerable to things like Russian disinformation efforts, where they may not even realize the origin of it. It's not like Russia came to them and said, "Hey, vote this way." Somebody on their Facebook page, probably someone they went to high school with, and has started some kind of conspiracy theories himself, or has read something that Russia started, has now passed that along, and then it's in your brain in a way that you're not even. It's not that you've been brainwashed, but it is a little bit like that, because it gets in there and if it's reinforced enough from enough people you trust, it doesn't matter whether Russia told you directly. It's if they started the idea, if they sowed the discord and it worked on a few people you know, then it has a chance of working on you.
So Malib, you jump in here because you study disinformation campaigns. What is the goal as you see it? Is it to actually manipulate the votes, or is it just to create civil strife?
You know, I think we do have this problem with how we approach this issue in terms of how it's discussed, because in the last couple of years, the cyber efforts have tended to be totally conflated as a hard security issue with the information campaigns. Mm-hmm. And they're not the same thing. Mm-hmm. They're completely separate. And when you're talking about our votes changed, a.k.a. did someone hack into a machine and change a tally or change the way the machine is tallying, like, there's no documentation of that is solid that has been done. But that is not the same thing as saying, did these massive systemic Russian information campaigns that have been very well documented and are so interwoven in terms of narratives into the landscape of the right and the far right and on the far left in the 2016 campaigns, did these have an influence on how people were viewing the elections? Well, the answer is yes. I mean, if you look at Republican opinion on specific issues over a 2-year period during the time between 2015 and the U.S. election, when the Russian information campaigns were documented to have been the most intense, starting in summer of 2015 onward, there were 20-point swings or more in Republican opinion on key issues like trade, how we deal with our allies, views of authoritarian leadership, do you need a strong leader versus a more democratic leader, on key issues where how we view ourselves in the world and how we view ourselves as a nation, there were wild swings in opinion that were directly related to the types of narratives coming from Russians and amplified by others. And you cannot deny that the overall landscape of the information universe in the United States was not influencing how people were voting and how they were thinking in the election.
Let me get Alex in here from Matthias, Maine. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the program.
Hey, I was wondering, I had a comment for the...
Lost Alex. Sorry. We'll try you again, Alex. Thank you. Let's go to Rich in, let's see, you're in Massachusetts somewhere. Rich, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I live in Lunenburg.
Oh, Lunenburg. Great. Nice to have you. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Nice to have you. You had started the program, you asked a question about whether we should believe that Trump's going to do something to increase the safety, you know, increase the FBI ability to do these things, CIA. And I got to say that I don't think he's going to do anything, because it's not his. If any political party is going to do anything, it'll be Congress. And I think that's going to happen.
The Congress is the hope. All right, Rich, thank you. Let's get another thought in here from John in Kent, Ohio. Hi, John. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Well, I don't support virtually 90% of what Trump represents, but I think the greatest danger here is actually the disinformation and the psychological warfare that is being perpetrated by our own intelligence agencies. And I recommend people check globalresearch.ca and look up the phrase CIA Operation Mockingbird Control of the Media. And I believe that there's a desperate attempt by the military-industrial complex and the CIA's control of the media, and I would include
John,
NPR in this.
Okay, John, thank you very much for calling.
If I could just say globalresearch.ca is a Kremlin-funded disinformation think tank, so let's just put that off the list of things people need to read. It's well-documented. You can look that up online.
Natasha Bertrand, what happens to our politics, to our society, to our democracy if we don't address this threat by 2020?
Well, our elections, which is the very foundation of what the country was founded on, will be illegitimate. I mean, I think that we need to take the threat very seriously. You know, if the Russians or any other foreign adversary, for that matter, are allowed to kind of erode the foundation of our democratic processes, then it's really difficult to imagine what this country is even going to stand for anymore. And so I think that, again, the leadership needs to come from the top. It needs to come from Congress especially, which has actually, you know, when the Trump administration was trying to lift the sanctions on Russia early on during Trump's tenure, Congress actually stepped in and codified those sanctions into law and made it so that it would be, you know, more difficult for the president to lift those sanctions in the future. And I think that's, again, they need to keep imposing those kinds of checks and balances on this, because we're continuing to see denial on this from the White House. We're continuing to see efforts to delegitimize the intelligence community, you know, and things like what the previous caller just said about how the intelligence community and the CIA are controlling the media. I mean, these are conspiracy theories that we need to see the White House take action on and debunk, and I would not hold my breath on that. So I think that for now, like what the other caller said, we're going to need to really look to Congress to figure this out.
So, Tim Starks, that's certainly an option, but from a social media perspective and these social media titans, I mean, what's next here? And should we consider some sort of public service campaign in the run-up to these elections to help inoculate our electorate from this disinformation?
Yeah, I think that goes to what California is doing with the media literacy and some of those other states. I think one of the points that keeps coming up here is you know, the partisanship of the media. We have to call the balls and strikes here. And the last major election security, and this is much more oriented not toward the social media but toward the voting machines and some of those kinds of things. The last bill that had any real momentum while Republicans completely controlled Congress was called the Secure Elections Act. That bill stalled. It was a bipartisan bill. It stalled in large measure because the White House sent signals that it did not like the bill, and states complained to Republican lawmakers who were inclined to oppose it because they thought it might impose some additional burden on them. That is not me condemning the Trump administration or the Republicans in Congress myself. That's me stating the facts of what happened. So there are ways in which this is partisan in a way that Republicans have been responsible for stopping it. The House passed an election security related bill, H.R. 1, that also had some other government reform type provisions. That bill is not going to go anywhere in the Senate that is controlled by Republicans. And part of it is that there's a philosophical difference about some of the things we should do. Should we spend more money on voting machines? And if so, should it be federal money? And that's where there's some difference on between Republicans and Democrats. Then there's the issue of what kind of rules we want to create. And by nature, whether you like it or dislike it, a lot of Republicans are opposed to additional kinds of regulations in this area as of now. There is some bipartisan overlap where everybody agrees, and there is a chance that something can get done on election security writ large. But in both these buckets that we've talked about of the hacking versus the social media. But right now that's the situation that we're in that the partisan divisions have led to some halting of what could go forward.
Molly McHugh, I'll give you the last word in our last 20 seconds here.
I think that we know what 2020 is going to look like. The president's campaign manager was in Romania talking about how they are going to use a grassroots level information operations campaign to change the information landscape and win the election. It is not just foreign adversaries using these tools against us now. And until social media companies stop pretending they don't know what's going on, we're all exposed to this tool of warfare.
Molly McHugh, professor at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service, Natasha Bertrand from The Atlantic, and Tim Starks covering cybersecurity for Politico. Thank you all very much for an important and interesting conversation, listeners. I appreciate your time and comments as well. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.